I'm Brian Roth, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. After last week's brief layover in Colorado for a chat with Weltworks, we're returning to Spain this week. If you haven't already, you can check out a thematic part one to this episode featuring Xavier Losada, a brewer and bottle shop owner of B Beer Craft Beer and Cheeses. This time around, we catch up with Jeff Cialetti, a fellow writer and prolific traveler who's long covered the world's many alcoholic offerings. I've been lucky to know Jeff for some time, but we typically only see each other once or twice a year around the U.S. beer industry's big events of the Craft Brewers Conference and Great American Beer Festival. In June, however, we found ourselves in Madrid as part of a short media tour hosted by Mao San Miguel. It was as good a time as any to chat on and off the mic. Along with writing for All About Beer and Draft magazines, craftbeer.com and others, and having served as editor-at-large of Beverage World, Jeff has also written multiple books, including the most recent, The Drinkable Globe, also the name of his website where he tracks the wide world of booze. Needless to say, Jeff is well-versed in a variety of drinks, history, and their global connections, and continues to explore them. He's most recently diving deep into sake. But beer is still where we can find a wheelhouse, and that's what brought us together. So I decided it would be good to pick his brain about what he's learned and continues to think about in beer and beyond. This is Jeff Cialetti, writer, author, and drinker extraordinaire. Listen in.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much for joining, Jeff. Really appreciate it. I know one of the things that, as many times as we've crossed paths, it's nice to actually be able to sit down and have a directed conversation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We had to go all the way to Spain and do
you're
it.
Right. Of all the places, we're both in the same region in the U.S.
You live about 4 hours from me, but we had to do this
and
in Spain.
And here we are in Spain, finally sitting down to talk. I think the kind of the expertise, insight, perspective that you have, not just when it comes to beer, but with alcohol as a whole, is really unique. I don't know if there are too many American writers, I think, who have looked at things with the kind of broad perspective that you do and paid attention to things all across. And so for people who might not be familiar, obviously, I would say you're pretty prolific in terms of your writing and where you've wrote. But just in terms of kind of magazines, both as well as books, if you want to give a quick rundown in terms of kind of where your mind has been at in recent years with some of the things that you've written about.
Well, I mean, I've been writing about the beverage market for more than 15 years now. I used to be editor-in-chief of Beverage World magazine. I was there for 13 years, I think it was. I mean, I was senior editor for a few years at first, and then I was editor-in-chief for 8 years after that, and then kind of stuck around a little bit after I stepped down as, like, editor-at-large, but, you know, eventually the magazine ended up folding, so it was like after 130-something years, it got purchased by its competitor, and now it doesn't exist. They just took it off the market. Yeah. And but even before I fully left, I had been freelancing a bit. I mean, when I was working there full time, I wasn't doing any freelancing, obviously. But when I sort of had one foot out the door, I started doing some freelancing. So, you know, I've written for everybody from Draft, All About Beer. I continue to write for Beverage Media. There's Artists in Spirit I've been writing for. I write for 750 from time to time. I've been doing a little bit with a takeout too. You know, the Onion people, Cape or Not, from who was at Draft, went to work there, and she's thrown me a couple of assignments here and there, and that's been fun. Mm. And what else have I been doing?
Well, you've got so you've got three books.
Oh yeah,
out
I gotta
now?
Get to the. Yeah, I haven't even gotten to the books. I was at FSR for a while. I was kind of freelancing as their beer editor too. Three books out, one on the way. The Year of Drinking Adventurously was the first one. The second one was Beer FAQ. Most recent one to come out was The Drinkable Globe, and I just completed a book on sake, which is called Sakepedia. That'll be out next February. Mm-hmm. So,
and so I think bringing that up to give the volume of both places that you've been published as well as kind of where your mind has been across alcohol categories to kind of set the stage. I'm curious, when you think about beverage, I guess it could be alcoholic or otherwise, but for purposes of our conversation, maybe alcoholic beverages, what is it that that has your attention these days? What is it that you feel like you've been paying attention to or thinking about more often than not?
You're talking about any alcohol beverages? Well, I mean, you know, obviously I just finished a sake book, so I kind of immersed myself a lot in that, and I'm excited to see that there are finally a number of craft sake breweries popping up in the U.S. that are actually doing good stuff. I mean, the one that had always been great was Sake One out in Oregon, but no one really had ever matched them for the past 20 years. And then finally, we're getting some good ones. Brooklyn Cora in Brooklyn is amazing. There's Proper Sake in Nashville that's great. And then there are a few others in other places that are doing some really great stuff. But I'm really sort of encouraged by what I'm seeing there. You know, on the beer front, the interesting thing I've been seeing, since I do travel a lot, it's just in the past, you know, not even decade, but I'm just seeing how much American craft beer has sort of become a global thing. Not even craft beer in general, but sort of the American style of craft beer.
Now, do you mean that in terms of creativity or just IPA?
Well, mostly IPA. I would say it's probably, I'd say 75% IPA. But I mean, but not just. I mean, the thing is, the interesting thing about it is, you look at the UK now, they, you know, England invented the IPA, you know, and we adapted it centuries after its inception. And you look at some of the earlier IPAs, I mean, you look at, for instance, Brooklyn's IPA. I mean, East India, what do they call it? East India Pale Ale or something mm-hmm. they call it. They still make that, right?
As far as I know.
Yeah. So that's probably, what, 20-something years old now, that particular one. Now, that was pretty much an English-style IPA. I mean, that's when you get sort of the old-school IPA, that's what it tastes like. It's, you know, it's hoppy, but it's a little more balanced, a little more nuanced, and but now, you know, I've been going to London, you know, just about every year for the past several years, and it's interesting because you know, I look back to, I don't know, 2008 when it was probably when I went on my first proper pub crawl then, because I think all the other times prior to that I'd been in the UK, I hadn't really gotten that deep into beer, because I think between, like, I think the last time before I was in London in 2008 was probably 2002, and I had yet to even get into beer at that point. But so then, like, 2008, I started doing, like, the real ale crawl, you know, at pubs and stuff, and you still had, you know, it was all basically that. You'd get the cask versions of classic English styles. You know, everyone have some sort of, you know, they always have a pale. They always have, you know, probably a porter. And then, in a lot of cases, you would find sort of the old school style IPA. Now, I've sort of gradually watched that sort of transition. You know, you got a lot of craft breweries that popped up in the UK in the past 10 years, and they've all sort of been eschewing the traditional English stuff. I don't want to say all of them, but a lot of them have been, and they've started making a lot of things based on what Americans are making. So you get a lot of American style IPAs there. And then most of them aren't on cask either. A lot of them are just doing draft. And so yeah, you're seeing like the basically the country that invented the IPA is now adopting what we had turned IPA into.
Mm-hmm. The I know in my recent international travels, I think I've seen that in countries in which I did not initially expect it, whether it was using IPA, whether it was equivalent to the India Pale Ale being made in America is another conversation entirely, which we may get to. But the Connor and modern, you know, late hop use focus heavily on aroma. Recipes, Italy, Iceland, even a little bit, very little bit here in Spain, finding people who are thinking about it in those terms. For some of the travel that you've done, maybe even specifically non-English speaking countries, have you seen that kind of interest or thought process in terms of some of the beer styles reflecting what's going on in America as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, I think the ones that stand out in my mind, obviously, because you know I've gone to some beer bars in places like Hong Kong and Japan and things like that, and their styles are very, very much replicas of what we're doing here. They have bars like there's a bar in Hong Kong that is almost completely dedicated to not just American style stuff, but American imports too. Mm-hmm. So you go, in addition to finding, you know, the Young Master, which is the one of the craft breweries there and things like that, you know, you're going to find stuff from Stone, you're going to find stuff from Rogue and all that other stuff there. And
are the native recipes that for people who are making beer in these locations, we'll use Hong Kong as the example, for those breweries that exist there, how close are those products in terms of what people may think about, or I should say how Americans think about IPA? Is it an actual replica or is it just a hoppy thing?
No, I think it's for the most part, and again, and it's sort of changing every year too, because I was in Hong Kong. It's already been about 3 years, and from what I've heard since, I mean, the scene was kind of burgeoning then, and from what I've heard since then, it's just completely exploded. So they still kind of had the training wheels on then. There were a few breweries, like I mentioned, Young Master, that and then there's Moon's Inn and things like that that had started to emerge. And, you know, a lot of them, for the most part, were doing, when they were doing American styles, they were pretty much replicas. They were using American hops and that kind of thing. But some of them also have, you know, to their credit, tried to kind of create their almost own indigenous styles, because, you know, Hong Kong doesn't have a style. But, like, for instance, they would incorporate some Chinese spices and ingredients like that. So a couple of people do that. It's more of the exception than it is the rule over there, but it's nice to see when somebody's trying to, you know, you can use the term terroir if you want. Mm-hmm. And to do that, that's the type of stuff that I really want to see more of, because I'm really kind of afraid of everything becoming so homogenized across the world, because I like to travel and I like to eat and drink what's local, you know, their traditions. But in a lot of places, local traditions are dying. The younger generations, they're more cosmopolitan. They're, you know, they drink international spirits, and they really like craft beer based on what's going on in America. So you can go to Hong Kong and get an IPA that tastes just like one you're gonna drink in New Zealand or California, or
Is that reflective of other alcohol styles too? So if there's, you know, spirits, cocktails or something like that, the kind of, for maybe lack of a better term, the one-track mind that comes when it to beer, at least what people are thinking about currently with beer, is what's happening in the other categories of alcohol. Is there more interest, especially, you know, maybe the sake might be a good example, whether it's being made here or in the U.S. or other places, is there more of an approach to make it unique to where it exists, or is there continually a look toward one particular region to drive what everybody else is doing around the world?
Well, to use, there's a couple of different categories that I can use as an example, but to use the sake example first, interestingly, there are some of the newer, you know, craft sake producers in the U.S. A lot of them have sort of articulated this goal to create an American style of sake.
What does that mean exactly?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's
part of that too. Is it my own curiosity? I have had sake before, but certainly would not even consider myself a novice. In that, I recognize what it is and I remember what it tastes like, but I have no idea what would define a regional sake.
I think what people are trying to do is it's more from a pairing standpoint. Mm-hmm. Like they want things. They don't want people just to be drinking it with Asian food. They want things that'll pair with hamburgers, and they want things that'll pair with pizza and things like that. And sake is very versatile in that regard to begin with. You know, people have said to me, you know, sake is very forgiving, and it is, because it was never developed as a food pairing thing. It was developed to, you know, as much as it was developed to pair, it was developed to pair with very, very regional food in Japan. Wherever that sake was being produced, it typically paired with whatever their local cuisine was. So, I mean,
it wasn't meant to be drank as a sake bomb by 21-year-old college students.
And it's like, and now people talk about like mountain sake versus ocean sake, or I forget the term. It's
what are the differences?
Well, it's not much of a difference. It's more like, okay, in the mountains they're eating a lot of they're not eating a lot of seafood, and you know, it's more I don't know, like stews and you know, some meats and vegetables and, you know, whatever grows in rural areas. Mm. So by default, their sake is going to match with that well. And then by default, the people who are on the coastline, their sake is going to go well with seafood. You know, whether that was really by design or just the way it sort of just evolved, I would say it's probably more the latter. It just sort of evolved, you know, because that's what they were traditionally eating, and eventually, and they were drinking sake with it, and you know, eventually the recipe sort of just got fine tuned because they just wanted to drink more of it with what they were eating. So I guess the point I was making, and now even in Japan, you know, sake consumption's been declining, much as overall beer consumption has been declining in the U.S. You know, they're relying on export markets to drive growth. And in the U.S., it's growing about 10% a year. So they themselves, Japanese brewers, and I visited a bunch of them back in November, and a lot of the sort of the recurring theme with them, a lot of them was, we've made this one because we think it'll pair well with American food. You know, like this will be great with a hamburger or something like that.
So, and in a very small way, it sounds still like that homogenization is happening just in reverse.
Almost in reverse. Yeah. But again, it's not, it's almost like you have to kind of take their word for it that this pairs with American food. In the same way that people are saying that they want to develop an American-style sake, I think that's just their way of saying the American. That's their way of saying that, yeah, this might not taste exactly what you had in Japan. It's an American style. It's almost like they're covering their asses saying
that so long as it goes well with
that
the hamburger.
That it's like, yeah, I mean, we're... And part of it has to do with the rice, too, because I don't want to go into the weeds on rice varieties or anything like that. I mean, it'll all be in my book, because, and believe me, I can go off on a tangent. But the bottom line is that, you know, there's some, I don't know, 100 varieties of rice in Japan that are considered sake rice, and they're different from eating rice. It's the most common one used in America grows in California, and it's sort of a descendant of one of the biggest sake rice strains in Japan, but it's just a descendant. It's not a clone, you know. Mm-hmm. So most of the brewers have been using that. However, there's a farmer in Arkansas who is probably the first to successfully grow, one of the most common and most prized sake strains. It's called Yamane Nishiki. I probably pronounced it wrong. I always do, and I'm not gonna spell it. But Yamane Nishiki. It's they successfully grew it in Arkansas. So more and more of the newer American breweries are gonna be experimenting with that, and maybe they will make something that's closer to Japanese sake. But in my opinion, the good brewers in the U.S., what they're brewing stands up incredibly well to some of the best stuff you're going to get in Japan.
So that connects nicely to the comment you made about the growth of sake in the U.S.
Yeah.
So 10% year over year is what you had mentioned. For that connection amongst everything else that goes on in the alcohol industry in the U.S., I'm curious if you could maybe provide any context about if there's something in particular going on, not just with sake, but also just the way that you've seen Americans drink or show interest in various kinds of alcohol, why it is, if there's a particular trend or a way that you think Americans are thinking about alcohol that has allowed for that to happen.
Yeah, no, and it's sort of overarching across all categories. It's this whole authenticity, artisanal thing that's, you know, it started with beer. And not just in drinks either. It's in food as well. It's just sort of like one category trend begets another category trend begets another category trend. So, you know, craft beer paved the way for craft distilling. In the same regard with the sake, it's people are more adventurous in what they eat. You know, obviously Japanese food's popular, so they got interested in that. But as far as distilling goes, it was the authenticity thing. Spirits had a steep decline in the 70s, at a time when beer was, it's like the fortunes of beer and spirits are sort of contradictory. Is the word I'm looking for, like converse or something like that. It's like as beer drops, spirits goes up and vice versa. And so in the 70s, the whiskey market, you know, basically hit a wall right around 1970 was probably its peak. And then, you know, I've seen a chart where it sort of slopes down for the next couple of decades. And while that was when beer was sort of expanding, especially as Anheuser-Busch started like growing almost exponentially, they really grew the U.S. market. Of course, the U.S. market consolidated incredibly then, but it was still growing, you know, regularly up until, I want to say, I know when I started at Beverage World, beer was still growing a little bit, you know, so I started there in 2003. So it was like probably 10 or 11 years ago is when beer started to have its sort of year on year steady decline by half a percentage point. But with spirits, it's been taking some of the drinking market share away from beer. There's been this incredible whiskey renaissance. You know, no one, like, around 1980, nobody wanted to drink bourbon. I mean, it was your grandfather's drink.
Why is it that people want to drink bourbon now?
It's basically...
Is it Mad Men?
Well, no, I mean, Mad Men gets like a touch of the credit for it.
It was
climbing. It's a footnote. I mean, Bourbon was on the rise before Mad Men even started. I mean, the turnaround probably started in the very late 90s, early 2000s, when you started to really see a comeback for, you know, whiskey in general. But it's, again, it speaks to this, and it's a lot of it is millennials. It's, it speaks to, and you know, I like to think that my generation, Gen X, had something to do with it too. Like those of us who care about such things. Yeah.
When I look at the way that the three alcohol categories are changing in the U.S., beer flat and slightly declining, wine very slightly increasing, also kind of plateauing the same opposite direction as beer, and then spirits very slowly gaining, and it's all... It all, like you said, fluctuates up and down, but it seems very clear, not just the way that the sales show, but also I think the way in the public consciousness, the way that people talk about things beyond just beer. Craft beer being much more pop culture now is easy to talk about. And even, you know, my family, my parents, grandparents know, you know, they may call it a microbrewery, but they know what craft beer is.
Yeah.
But I feel like the way that people are talking about it, and perhaps more important, talking about it with excitement, spirit seems to be very kind of front of mind in terms of what matters in growth right now. Sake being one example, bourbon and other, are there things that you're
sake is not a spirit.
Oh, sorry. Yes. In the way that people are thinking about talking about non-beer categories.
Yeah.
Are there things that you've seen lately that you think shows why people are or should be paying more attention to these things?
Well, I mean, I think, again, aside from the fact that people have just gravitated towards whiskey. And again, it's a lot of it has to do with, to some extent, people want to rediscover their heritage and whatever. And, but I also think, if you look on the craft here, I'm not talking about, you know, the Maker's Marks and the bigger brands, cause they're doing great. I mean, and that's always been sort of the difference between craft beer and craft spirits. I'm going on a tangent here, but I'm going to bring it back to the point.
Go ahead.
So,
you have the floor.
I'm not pivoting away from the question. I just kind of want to do a little context. You know, craft beer, and I've said this a lot, is craft beer came about as essentially a protest against... the homogenization of the beer category. I mean, it was like things consolidated down so much that, you know, you just ended up with one global beer style, and which is a phenomenal beer style. And I'm so glad that craft brewers finally, you know, decided to give Pilsner a second look and have been doing amazing stuff with it. But it was actually, you know, the big guys bastardized it and it became flavorless, and so craft beer was a protest against that. I said, look, there's these other styles. Beer can have a lot more flavor. Beer can be so many different things, and that's what got the movement going. Craft spirits really has a different dynamic to that, because there was no real protest against what the big guys were doing, because the big guys are doing incredible things. And there's never been a flavor or style problem, really, with, you know, for instance, you look at bourbon. I mean, huge conglomerates own the biggest, the best brands. You know, Beam Suntory owns Maker's Mark, and, you know, you got, you know, Brown Forman with Woodford Reserve and things like that. So, and those are great things. And most of the stuff that craft distillers are doing can barely touch that stuff, you know, because they have to be focused more on innovation and doing things with interesting grains and things like that in order to really stand out. So I guess the point I was making was, they kind of the two movements kind of started in from different places. The only thing they really had in common was that we're small, we're artisanal, and you know, stick it to the man kind of thing, you know. But as far as style, quality, anything like that, flavor, the big guys have always had that covered. But well, I guess the point I was just gonna finish. Craft spirits is going to continue to grow at a faster clip than craft brewing, more because it's a newer segment than anything else. I mean, right now there are about 1,700 craft distilleries versus, 6,500 breweries. You know, eventually you're going to hit a ceiling in breweries on how much more the market can handle. Craft distilling still has a lot of runway to even reach that point. And even you're looking at a lot of breweries are starting to distill as well. I mean, you're getting, you're seeing the show floor at CBC is like, you're getting more and more stills, people selling stills and that things. Cause so many people, I think, there was something like 270, the TTB, has issued permits for, like dual permits for, they're separate permits, but for companies that are doing both distilling and brewing, there are about 200 something, and that number is growing pretty rapidly. So I don't know what my point was, but
the point is speaks to variation and where these two ideas or growth patterns may cross over in one way or another.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, the one thing that sort of distilling and anything small has going for it is, it's that authenticity thing. As long as, consumers believe that this is produced by like this small artisanal producer, they're going to be more interested in it. But the one thing that the distilleries have to catch up on is, they have to have more mature product, because a lot of the whiskey that they're putting out, is young, they're working on speedy aging and that sort of thing. Now, some of the ones that have been around a while, they finally have product that's old enough that's essentially proper whiskey that can hold its own against those bigger heritage brands. And, I think the UK and much of Europe, especially including Spain, has had this like gin explosion. And, a lot of people are making gin in the US that's growing, but it's not to the point of like whiskey. I mean, if gin were to get to that point, then craft distilleries would have like a little more leverage, because gin doesn't have to age. They can market a lot of gin, while they're waiting for their whiskey to age in the barrels and things like that, and then they can sort of remain solvent. Because I mean, I fear that anyone who's got any sort of investment, any investors that they have to pay back, eventually those investors are going to get antsy if like the stuff that's sitting in barrels isn't turning a profit.
GBH is partially underwritten by New Belgium Brewing, an employee-owned craft brewery with the oldest continuous sour culture in America. With New Belgium, we're bringing you a new series of stories called Into the Wild. Wild and sour ale in America is a story all its own, and we're still in the early foundational chapters. These are stories about how these beers challenge and inspire the brewers and drinkers who seek them out. GBH is also partially underwritten by Brewery Omegang out of Cooperstown, New York, home to the annual outdoor festival Belgium Comes to Cooperstown on August 3rd and 4th this year. It features Belgian and Belgian-inspired breweries from around the world. GBH will be there this year leading a series of discussions on the state of Belgian beer, what it means to people who make and drink it, and what it is about Belgian beer that seems to continuously inspire new generations of brewers in the US and around the world. GBH is also underwritten by Guinness, who we're collaborating with for our Coming to America series. Guinness began brewing, and never stopped, at St. James Gate in Dublin in 1759, and has been shipping beer to America since 1817. And recently, they celebrated their distribution to the U.S. with their 200th anniversary export stout. Coming to America stories highlight the iconic and upstart international brands that are making their way to America in the age of local. And of course, we're also supported by The Fervent Few, a growing community of hundreds of GBH readers, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pure Brewing Company, Magic Rock Brewing, Honest Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, Northern Monk Brew Co., The Five Points Brewing Company, London Fields Brewery, Boundary Brewing in Belfast, and Ireland Craft Beers, an exporter. In the US, we have the Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits in New York, Hops and Grain in Texas, Common House Ale Works in South Carolina, Acusta Brewing in North Carolina, Craft Beer Cellar, and Daredevil Brewing in Indianapolis. And then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa. They all support us through their monthly Pro Tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/fervent few.
You brought up an interesting point that I wanted to poke at a little bit. Talking about when you were speaking about kind of the revolutionary, I suppose, as it were, entrepreneurship. You know, with beer, it came about people protesting kind of the bland style that had become widely available. Distilleries, this flip side, it kind of came from just the ability to exist and create something new and innovate. My mind immediately jumped to because they couldn't keep up. The big producers are doing great things, mentioned. And my mind immediately jumped to trying to create this parallel between the way that, you know, craft beer enthusiasts think about their dismay or dislike toward large corporations being involved with beer, something of a vice versa in which the large corporations are making very beloved brands that spirit drinkers really enjoy. And part of this might be demographics. Up until the last 5 years or so, I don't think I've heard people talk about younger drinkers being an important part. Spirits has always been, quite honestly, an older person's alcohol. And so through your reporting, whether for book or stories, I'm curious if you've encountered aspects of something similar to what we've seen in beer happening in spirits. Do people care about, you know, obviously if it's a local business making something that's exciting, but I'm curious if there's that same kind of, maybe not outrage, but anger toward the impact that the largest multinational corporations may have on spirits that people almost universally enjoy.
You know, it's funny because I've kind of said it before that I think maybe not to an absolute extent, but to a much larger extent, in a lot of ways, spirits kind of get a pass on that versus beer. I mean,
why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, people are a lot more passionate when a craft brewery gets scooped up by, you know, a big company, you know, like Constellation buys Ballast Point or all the sundry companies that AB has bought. You know, there's outrage. I mean, you saw what happened when AB bought Wicked Weed. You know, everybody kind of dropped out of their what was the name of the festival? The
Funk Fest.
So like people were dropping out. I mean, that was, you know, they feel it more. But with spirits, and now again, there haven't been nearly as many acquisitions yet in spirits. I mean, there's some notable ones here and there, like some major investments, like, you know, Constellation, you know, give a ton of money to Catoctin Creek and things like that. And but I find that, and I think it has a lot to do with how well regarded these sort of surviving big brands that sort of managed to stick around during, you know, bourbon's decline or any other sort of whiskey's decline, that I don't think consumers have minded as much when, you know, it's, you know, the little drink Maker's Mark. Granted, the average consumer might not know who owns Maker's Mark. They think it's this folksy independent company. But I think people are savvy. A good number of people are savvy enough, and especially the ones who are really passionate about whiskey. They know who owns what, and they're not like, well, I'm not gonna not drink this because it's owned by a big company. That doesn't really happen as much in spirits.
There is one thing. I tangentially pay attention as best I can to things that go on in the spirits industry. And one of the things that I think has repeatedly caught my attention over the last few years has been innovation, maybe a kinder word, but the extension of brands in particular, especially for some legacy brands, Jack Daniels, creating flavored versions of their Crown Royal has found success doing it similarly too. Why do you think that is? In order maybe not to survive, but to continue to get attention, that these brands have had to do something that, you know, for beer drinkers, we see this often now with extension of brands that have been around for 20 years, flavored this, that, or the other, or barrel-aged something. Is there a reason why you think that's happened in spirits as well much more recently?
Well, there are a couple kinds of innovation. You get, you know, the sort of, you know, different barrel finishes, you know, and that mostly applies to, like, scotch more than anything else and other types of whiskey because, you know, with bourbon, for instance, you can only use the barrel once and you can't reuse it from something else. But, so things like that or slightly tweaked recipe like Jack Daniel's has Gentleman Jack, you know, that sort of thing, a little higher end. So that's one type of innovation, and those are meant for, with an eye towards the fact that people are savvier drinkers than they used to be. You know, maybe they want to graduate, maybe they're brand loyal to, say, Jack Daniel's, and they want to graduate to something a bit different, a little more complex. And that's who, like,
maybe a little more expensive.
So they can graduate to that and still stay within the Jack Daniel's brand halo because, you know, obviously, you know, Brown-Forman wants to keep people buying their products. And instead of somebody who's a regular Jack Daniel's drinker to get a wandering eye for, you know, a different Tennessee whiskey or something, or, you know, or bourbon or something like that, that keeps them sort of in their portfolio. Now, when you get like the flavored things, those are more for, the kind of bridge consumers, the people they're trying to bring in from other spirits categories. You know, for instance, vodka drinkers, you know, vodka's got no flavor and, you know,
specifically made to have no flavor.
People are getting curious. People who drink like vodka exclusively or, you know, drink their vodka in cocktails are not drinking it neat most of the time. But, you know, they've been hearing about, you know, oh, whiskey's making a comeback. I'm curious about this because I want something with a little more flavor, a little more aroma. But, you know, I remember drinking some bad whiskey in college or whatever like that, and I just don't like the taste of whiskey. This sort of is kind of a, like, it's a bridge. I guess that's the point. It's a bridge. It's a sort of soft entry into the category and kind of eases them into it. And if they really then get into whiskey, they'll be like, let me try proper whiskey without any of these sort of adornments or anything like that. And then, you know, like, for instance, like a Jack Daniel's hopes, okay, they get people into the core Jack Daniel's brand, and then eventually they get them up to their more expensive expressions and things like that. And
is there a connection there with beer, too? Because I know you've written recently, and you mentioned it just now, too, with the breweries who also distill.
Yeah.
Is there, in reporting that story or just even talking with people outside of it as well, is there some kind of connection there trying to express a beer's intent through trying to get someone who maybe hasn't thought about beer through some kind of spirit as well?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting thing too. I think that speaks to the fact that consumers increasingly are cross-drinkers. I mean, you know, you get certain people who only drink beer, but for the most part, if you look at the larger drinking population, people kind of dabble in different categories. They might have their core beverage. They might, you know, drink beer 75% of the time, but, you know, 10% of the time they want to try spirits. You know, 10% of the time they might want to try wine or sake or something like that. So I think that sort of speaks to that. I know, you know, I use myself as an example. Now, I'm not typical, and I don't think I'm typical of most drinkers just because I've just been around this stuff, and that I don't know if my experience is similar to others, but there are people with a similar experience where I used to just be a beer drinker, you know, and that's all I cared about. I wouldn't go to a bar if they didn't have a good beer selection. And this was back when most bars didn't always have a good beer selection, you know. It was like craft hadn't completely caught on. At that point, it was probably 3% of the... I mean, it was growing at about a 3% rate. It was probably 2% of the beer market at that point. So it was like... So you couldn't find it in a lot of places. You had to go to a beer bar to find a good beer selection. And those were few and far between. But that was the way it was. I was like, I want to drink good beer, especially when I just discovered it. It's all I wanted to drink. I don't know what got... I can't remember or pinpoint the exact moment when I started, like, I want to try drinking some other things sometimes. But I gradually morphed into these other categories. And then, you know... 15 years ago, if you looked at a pie chart, you know, if you looked at my drinking habits, it would be, you know, beer would take up like 99% of the pie, and then there'd be this little 1% sliver that would be everything else.
But weddings now, or special events.
Yeah. So fast forward to now, that pie is more like it's all over the place. It's like, okay, so beer might be this 25% sliver, and then spirits might be this slightly bigger sliver now, and then, you know, sake is a even bigger sliver, and, you know, and you know, wine is still about as small in my... I mean, it's, you know, I've always drunk wine, but I don't really seek it out. So the point I'm making is that I think people's tastes evolve. People... once they discover new flavors, they want to discover new flavors in other categories. They just get curious about other categories. And I think that any brewer who is incorporating, you know, distilling into their operation, again, it's not like, I wouldn't even call it like a cash cow. It's not like just a money grab on their part. It's just because, especially if they want to make whiskey, it's going to be a while before they're making a profit off of that. But it really does recognize that people want to drink different things at different times. And if you've already established a recognizable trademark with your brand, you know, like you look at I don't know, New Holland, you know, they've been distilling for a while. And people who are familiar with New Holland beer who might want to explore spirits... that's their way of keeping them in the family.
Makes it safe and easy.
Yeah, and the same thing with Rogue. Rogue's been doing it for 15 years now, and from what I've been hearing, the distillery's doing better than the brewery's doing. I mean, not the distillery's still way small compared to, it's like definitely less than 10% of the business, but I mean, it's growing more than the brewery is. And Dogfish Head, you know, they've been doing it about as long as Rogue's been doing it, but it was only just like last year or 2 years ago that they really made a huge investment behind it. They moved the distilling operation from the brew pub to the Milton Brewery. They started expanding into other states because they only used to just have their spirits available, you know, at the brewery, at the brew pub, or a couple very select retailers around Delaware, you know. But now they're in Maryland. I think they're in Virginia. It's still that general region, but they are expanding out, and it's still, you know, distilling is only about a percentage of Dogfish Head's business, but the Dogfish Head trademark has cachet, and if you're starting out as a beer person and you're looking to sort of wander into spirits, it's still kind of keeping you in beer, and it's keeping you with a trademark, you know, and that, you know, and Dogfish Head is savvy to know that that keeps them in the family. And so I think especially, I think it might be harder for a new startup brewery to be like, well, I'm going to start up as a brewery and a distillery. I mean, you kind of have to focus on one or the other at that point. You have to establish an identity before, you can't be everything to everybody, basically. But when you're somebody who's established, like Dogfish Head, Rogue, New Holland, Ballast Point even, who've made a name for themselves in brewing, you definitely can do yourself a lot of favors by expanding into another category with your trademark.
So a story like that, focusing on something that's going on in the U.S. more recently, for the way that you very purposely think about what goes on beyond the U.S. border, what are some of the things that you've been thinking about or that have caught your eye, whether it's reporting or people you've talked to or travels that you've had that you think might be unique or interesting what's going on globally? And in any kind of alcohol category, I'm curious if there's things that you've experienced or heard about or are thinking about now, maybe a bit more recently in terms of kind of the global market of alcohol and the way the things that may be shifting or growing or evolving.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that are happening. There is sort of, again, this homogenization thing happening. It's more and more countries are starting to... making whiskey more than you would have thought. France has been doing some single malts and
is that strange? It sounds strange to me, but I don't know if that is globally.
Well, it's not, because it's the weird thing is everybody wants to be able to do is bourbon, but they can't, because you can't call it bourbon if it's not made in the U.S. some people will call it that and just but a lot of times what they'll do is they'll do like a single malt and it'll be finished in bourbon barrels. And that way they can like have the word bourbon on the label, single malt actually in the U.S. is growing. More and more people are doing single malt, and you're seeing it in a lot of other countries that you wouldn't have traditionally thought of it in. Like I said, France is doing it. Cavillon whiskey in Taiwan, and places like that where, suddenly there's a market for it. And
what's the comparison in terms of, I'll use air quotes around quality because it's all subjective, but in terms of how it stands up against what people would think of as proper whiskey or bourbon from the U.S., are these kind of projects that need some refining, or do you think that people are going in and doing a good job from the start?
A lot of them are actually winning awards, international awards. A lot of them need some work, but for the most part, people are taking it seriously. And I think, people have been taking Japanese whiskey seriously for a while, but that wasn't always the case. Now Japanese distillers, whose whiskeys are based on Scotch whiskey, they're doing better stuff than a lot of Scotch distilleries are doing.
How does that happen?
It's just...
Is there something that you've experienced or in talking with people that would allow somebody from outside the country to pass the?
Well, I think that's a lot of it. It's also it's sort of particular to Japan, because it's like Japan can take just about any product and make it better. They've just always been able to. I don't know if it's the work ethic. It's the fact that they're very, quality is a huge thing. And, for instance, it's like you can get amazing coffee in Japan, outdoing Italian coffee, and stuff like that. It's based on cappuccinos and things like that, but they'll do it better than the Italians do it. And, same thing happened with whiskey. I think that they just kind of, they can adapt it and they can perfect it. And I guess it's sort of, there is sort of a kind of perfectionist, vibe, there, that it's just like, we're going to make this better. And it's sort of kind of what's happened. And it's great, because it's like, that's why I love going to Japan so much, because I'm never going to have a bad experience anywhere I go. Even like the worst dining experience I've had in Japan is still better than the best I've had in a lot of other countries, So it's like, It's like that. But
are there other countries that have caught your eye in terms of something different that they're doing that has been particularly interesting? So, like, you know, whiskey in France or Taiwan, I would not have guessed those.
Yeah, but I mean, again, I think that a lot of they're not doing anything. I think a lot of these countries, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get people's attention, making it taste like something they're familiar with. So
let me flip that on you a little bit. Is there a place where you'd like to visit to try something that is new that has caught your eye?
Well, what I really am interested in is, and this is sort of happening in a lot of different countries, people are sort of rediscovering their own sort of traditional spirits and things like that, and you know, they're starting to find their way in cocktails and things like that. It used to be like this rot gut stuff their grandparents would drink, but now it's actually in the same way that sort of whiskey, you know, bourbon and stuff got sort of came back in the U.S. I think people were sort of rediscovering that part of their heritage in a lot of different countries. So it's not any one particular country, but it's more not that I haven't tried the spirit, it's that I haven't tried it in its natural sort of habitat. That's what I'm kind of interested in, because a lot of things I have and a lot of things I haven't. There's a spirit in Bolivia, Singani, that I've really come to enjoy, but I haven't had it in, I haven't been to Bolivia, so I haven't tried it in Bolivia, but I would really love to sort of try it in that.
What is that, and why would it be special to have it in Bolivia?
Well, Singani is, I mean, it's not entirely unlike Pisco. It's made from grapes, it's distilled from grapes, but it's only one specific type of grape. It's Muscat of Alexandria, which is one special varietal variation of Muscat, and it grows at like these super high elevations. I think it's got to grow over a mile up. And the fact that it grows up there, it grows in such thin air, the UV rays have a lot more influence on the fruit, so you get a lot more character from it that way. So it's, you get a lot more floral character. So you can taste it alongside a Pisco, and it tastes completely different because it's got all that other stuff going. So that's sort of the Bolivian beverage, and I would love to drink it at like a high elevation on a mountain, you know, in Bolivia, just to kind of experience that vibe. And, you know, the same can be said for, you know, as much as I'm just, you know, Baijiu, I've written about that, but I've only had the super, super high-end stuff that they export here. I
haven't. Where is that from?
China.
China, okay.
And I haven't had it in China, and I would love to try to see if it's... I mean, it's a challenging flavor with the good stuff. I'd just be curious to taste the stuff that's not good enough to
export
here.
What does it taste
here.
Like? What's the equivalent?
My best description is if you take a mushroom and you dip it in chocolate and then...
Okay.
Grill it with a pineapple.
Wow.
I mean, it's...
All right.
It's challenging.
Yeah,
it's,
that sounds interesting.
It's distilled mostly from sorghum, but a lot of other grains, and and it's usually around like 55% alcohol. And
so the description of that leads in perfectly to where I kind of wanted to give you the last word too. Mm-hmm. For people who often listen to this podcast, you know, we focus on beer and conversations are often around beer. But from your perspective, why is it that people should have interest looking beyond that? Why is it that people, maybe Americans in particular, why is it that there should be interest in the other alcohol categories that exist, especially at this moment in time?
I think that it's... I think you're only exploring a culture with like one arm tied behind your back if you're only interested in their beer. And, you know, as I said, so much of the beer you're going to find in other places is based on what you already know anyway. Don't you want to, like, learn a little more about the world and what their traditions are? You know, we just lost Anthony Bourdain, and this is what he was all about. And I share that philosophy. I share the food philosophy, but I also share it. You know, it's my sort of drinking philosophy too. Is it's like, try to preserve as many of these global traditions as you can, and you have to discover them. Otherwise, they're just going to die out, and I think the world is going to kind of become too samey. So that's why, I mean, as much as, so it's like, even in America, like you're not getting a full picture of America if you're just drinking its beer. I mean, we have a very rich whiskey tradition that people shouldn't be shutting themselves off of. And I can say the same thing for wine people too. It's like everyone goes in Napa and goes on their wine tastings and everything like that, and they don't think to go do the same thing at a brewery or at a distillery. But you can have that same sort of exploratory journey. You get a lot more diversity too in what you're tasting. So really it's about fully embracing a culture in all its facets. You're not going to like everything you try, and you know, it's okay for beer to continue to be your go-to drink, to be what you're going to drink most of the time. But once in a while, don't be that person who's in a great whiskey bar and is like, oh, I see you have, you know, Stone IPA. I'll have that. You know, it's just, it's more about a when in Rome kind of thing more than anything else. And it's both international and it's sort of intercategorical, you know? It's sort of like, if this is what this place specializes in, why not have that? Get out of your comfort zone.
Yeah. Grab your passports and have at it. Cool. Thank you so much, Jeff.
No, thanks for having me, Ryan. I really had fun.
Thanks for listening this week. If you like the international feel of this chat, make sure to check out the latest from Matthew Curtis on the Good Beer Hunting website, where he breaks down Heineken's recent minority stake purchase into Beavertown Brewery and what it could mean for the future of the UK beer industry. We also have Sightline's features exploring how Boston beer could lose its craft brewer status from the Brewers Association, and why modernizing laws in Oklahoma helped encourage the state's biggest craft brewery invest heavily into its future. In her latest for GBH, Alyssa Pereira goes in residence at the Firestone Walker Invitational, where she offers up a dispatch showing the fun and excitement of one of the country's most beloved beer festivals. Check out some stunning photos from Stephanie Bice, too. And lastly, the Fervent Few talk yeast, hops, spice, and everything nice, exploring favorite and unique ingredients that can raise their interest in a beer. Thanks to everyone who shared their insight, including members Manny Gumina, Colleen O'Sullivan, and Quentin Cook. If you want to join the fun and become a part of the Fervent Few, check out goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew. As part of the community, you get access to a host of perks in addition to sharing your voice with those of us on the GBH editorial team. We are so thankful for the support, encouragement, and inspiration of the Fervent Few and what they offer beer lovers too. Thanks to all of our readers and listeners who make Good Beer Hunting a part of their routine. That's it for this week. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, or liberal, folks. Have a great week.